Don't touch that dial. You're tuned in to the Dread Podcast Network.
You are now listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris, where the most influential voices in horror cinema will spill their guts to the renowned horror director, writer, and producer. Now, here's your host, Mick Garris.
From Night Sky Productions' world headquarters overlooking the glamorous San Fernando Valley, I'm Mick Garris, and this is Postmortem. Filmmakers are usually obscured behind the camera. It is the on-screen talent, the actors who are the name brands that drive the box office. But in the world of horror cinema, in many cases, it's the filmmaker who becomes the brand name. Horror films don't require a star on the screen to become successful, but they do need a captain behind the ship to steer the audience through their on-screen nightmares. A handful of directors have earned their name brand status as their involvement increases the likelihood of a film's success. Who among us wasn't excited to see the new John Carpenter or Tobe Hooper or Wes Craven movie? Or today, Mike Flanagan or Jordan Peele, Ari Aster, or our guest on this episode, James Wan? Their films often are cast with excellent actors, most of whom were unfamiliar before appearing in the films by our celebrity directors. James Wan has one of the most unique careers in our genre as a writer, a director, and a producer. He has produced in three original franchises, well close to $2 billion at the box office. Actually, by now, it's probably closer to three. But he's been able to successfully jump genres, though he always seems eager to jump back into the realm of fright and fear. He wears many hats and has had matchless success in spreading our genre into a mainstream world, and we're happy to have him here on the slab today to talk about his past, present, and future, and his devotion to the horror we all love. For Gooble Gobble, he is one of us. The Postmortem Podcast is going out not with a whimper, but a bang. Dread, Beyond Fest, and the American Cinematheque will be hosting our final show at the historic Egyptian Theater on Hollywood Boulevard, and you can be there in our live audience. Many of the Postmortem guests will be there on stage and in the audience on Saturday, December 9th. We'll follow the live show with a screening of Stephen King's Sleepwalkers for an unforgettable night. Tickets are available at the American Cinematheque's website, so I look forward to seeing you there. And now, on with the show. James, thank you for finally finding the time in your amazing schedule.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. Thank you for having me, and thank you for keeping the door open for me towards the end of your journey on this podcast.
Well, you've become such an integral part of what the genre has become, and from very modest beginnings. Mm-hmm. But tell me, you were born in Malaysia. You were only 7 years old when you went to Australia. So what were the things in your childhood, was horror a part of your life from childhood on?
Yeah. I mean, scary stories have definitely been a big part of my childhood growing up. Born in Malaysia and growing up in a traditionally Chinese family meant that I grew up with a lot of, you know, really exciting and scary sort of superstitious stories. You know, Culturally, we're very superstitious people. So what that meant was I grew up with, you know, just a lot of interesting sort of stories and beliefs. And I think a lot of that shaped me and shaped my love for the horror genre.
So were your parents also part of the culture telling you these stories from your childhood?
Yeah, my parents, my grandparents, my aunties and uncles. It's just kind of who we are. We love our ghost stories. We love supernatural things, and it's, you know, it's part of the religion as well. And so, so it was definitely a big makeup of me during my young age.
Yeah, I remember being in Kuala Lumpur and seeing billboards for The Bride with White Hair and things like that. Those movies were they a part of your coming of age?
Pretty much, yeah. I definitely grew up with all the classic sort of Hong Kong ghost stories and the Hong Kong sort of action films as well, but I think my fondest memories. I think my first horror movie that I can put my finger on that I saw at a young age in a theater was Poltergeist.
Oh, really?
So Poltergeist definitely made a huge impact on me, yes. I truly believe my love for creepy dolls stem from that movie, and I have Toby to thank for that.
Yeah, well, from Dead Silence to Megan, yes, and all steps in between, and Annabelle, of course.
Yep.
Creepy dolls have been a part of your life.
It's been a big part of my life. It's been a big part of my... Just my love for the genre, and it's been, you know, it's been very good for me from a I guess financial standpoint.
Well, for sure, but also creatively fulfilling. If your first memories are of ghost stories, and here you're scaring the shit out of people, you know,
that's right. I'm always like, you know, people ask me, do you have a formula for how you scare people? And I just say, I use myself as, you know, as the gauge. I use myself as the thermometer. I think I'm very of the average sort of, you know, I have a very sort of like everyday people mentality, I think. And so I think that helps me to kind of know what it is that makes, you know, just the general public tick and what scares them. And so that's what I do. I try to make movies or tell stories that ultimately scares me.
Yeah,
and if I feel like if it scares me, chances are, you know, hopefully there are other people out there that feels the same way.
Well, fear is kind of universal in that regard. If it scares me, I figure it's going to scare other people, and the ones that don't, fuck them.
That's right. I also feel like, you know, just...
Of course I'm joking, but only to make a point. Yeah,
I get that point. But I do think the reason why there's certain themes, there's certain stories that are universal. You know, like, there's a reason why haunted house movies work, because... We all come from families. We all grow up in a household of some kind, and we all can relate to that, right? So I tend to enjoy scary movies that I can kind of see myself inside of that story.
Yeah.
And that, to me, is the key to making something that can connect with the general public, at least for me. I'm not saying horror movies need to be like that, but those are the kind of movies that attract me.
Well, that's one of the important things about the horror side of your career, is that you've drawn in a mainstream audience that is not normally part of the horror audience. There used to be a big divide between horror fans and a mainstream audience, but you have straddled that and sewn it together.
Yeah, thank you for pointing that out. I do think that I'm pretty proud of that, because I remember, even on my first movie, Saw, I remember that our genre was still pretty much seen as the bastard stepchild.
Absolutely.
and
the gutter genre. Yeah.
It is. Yeah, it's the gutter genre. It's the it's the genre that never got any respect, and I am the first to point out to anyone in our business that this is the genre that kept our business alive.
Yeah.
Like it literally, when everything else was falling apart, people are still coming to the movies, to theaters, to watch our movies, to watch our horror films. And finally, it's really crossed over into the mainstream. And I think people like, you know, Jordan Peele really brought it into the mainstream in a big, big way as well. And I do think that, with my subsequent movies like The Conjuring, I think it really kind of crossed over into a new generation of moviegoers.
Absolutely. And, Insidious as well. Although the first one may not have had the financial success that Saw did, it spawned its own franchise, which reached a very big audience.
Yeah, and I do think, telling story in a world, in an environment that people can relate to, really kind of helped it. And again, I give a lot of this love and credit to movie like The Poltergeist that I grew up with, which is, for the first time I saw a horror film, or I see a horror story that I can kind of go, oh, wow, that looks like it could be us.
Yeah.
It wasn't like a big creaky old house in the woods in the middle of like nowhere. It was just, it was in the suburbs. It was something that we can kind of relate to.
It's that Toby Hooper, Steven Spielberg combination. And I was lucky enough to be on the set doing the making of, working on the making of Poltergeist.
Oh, wow.
And I interviewed Steven for that documentary.
Oh my God.
And just watching these two masters.
Right.
Joining forces, a very strong producer and a director who was new to studio filmmaking.
Studio filmmaking, right.
And watching that whole process happen.
Yeah, that must have been amazing. Yeah.
It was, but it also brings me to your career because you've made that big step. But let's talk, how did Saw first happen? You went to film school in Melbourne.
I did. I went to a media art school. It was more an art school than anything else. Like the concept.
This is RMIT?
RMIT, sorry. Yeah. Yes, RMIT, the Royal Melbourne Institute of Technology. It was where I met my buddy Lee Winnell. We would go on to do many things together, many projects together. But that was where I met Lee. And the reason why Lee and I got along really well was we were literally the youngest kids in our classes.
Really?
It was a class. It was a
so course. You were like a teenager?
We were like, we were fresh out of high school. Yeah. Most of the students in our course were, you know, much older students, like in their 20s or even early 30s and stuff like that. So Lee and I really were the babies of our classes. And so because of that, you know, like we had a lot in common. We share a lot of the same love for movies and cinema. We had the same passion for wanting to tell those kind of stories, and so we got along, and our courses really gave us the opportunity to kind of experiment and try things that were not, you know, that were not traditionally what a film school would teach,
right?
Because it was an art school.
Right, and did they hold their nose when you got into the horror genre? And go, ooh, I don't want to get that red, icky stuff on me. Yeah.
Ironically, our professors were actually very cool. They were horror filmmakers themselves.
Ah.
So they were actually, if you can kind of be snobby, but in the opposite way. So like they'll be snobby against all the highbrow movies, but like for them, they would teach us, you know, during our classes, they'll teach us Roger Corman,
wow,
Toby Hooper. They'll really get into like grindhouse cinema. And so it was really fun for us growing up.
So who were your inspirations? Aside from Poltergeist, what were the movies that you sought out or the filmmakers who really you looked forward to whatever they were going to do next?
I would say, I mean, my inspirations were pretty varied, just again, because I was I was introduced to filmmakers around the world. So I kind of, I know I grew up with, like I said, the Hong Kong directors, like
right,
the Su Hawk, John Woo, like all the classics, right?
Ronnie
that people now
Yu
love them. Ronnie
yeah.
Yu, yeah, all the classics. And I mean, one of my favorite films is Kwaiden. And
oh,
so,
yeah.
So definitely I'm a big fan of Japanese ghost cinema.
Yeah.
But then I would really say that the biggest, strongest influence on me was when I hit my teen years and I discovered Italian cinema.
Dario Argento.
Dario is definitely my man, yeah. Dario and Mario Bava.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, talk about people who created a palette for filmmaking
yes.
tools.
Yeah, I definitely think Dario and Mario.
Dario and Mario.
Argento and Bava were the two filmmakers that probably had the strongest sort of visual impact on me as a filmmaker. In terms of the horror genre, I would say. And I definitely, I'm a fan of that sort of, that Baroque style of horror filmmaking.
Yeah.
That kind of really rich, deep palette.
The Suspirias and...
Yeah,
you know, primary colors contrasting with one another,
oh, yeah,
and
yeah.
A mobile camera, sinewy moves.
Yeah. Yep, definitely. I would say probably my favorite would be, I love Profondo Rosso in the giallo genre, but my favorite would be A Drop of Water.
Oh, yeah.
Bava's A Drop of Water.
Yeah, from the segment of the anthology movie.
Yeah, from Black Sabbath, right?
Yes,
yeah,
Black
yeah,
Sabbath.
Yeah, 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 yep.
Black Sunday is the Barbara
yeah.
Steele
one. Yeah, Black Sunday is the Barbara Steele one. That's
yeah.
right. So I would say that sort of Italian, and eventually, you know, I discovered Fulci as well, and then the more obscure ones.
Yeah.
But in terms of mainstream filmmakers, the sort of more mainstream Hollywood filmmakers, I grew up loving people like Cameron,
yeah.
Spielberg, you know,
yeah.
Lucas. It's kind of hard not to like those guys. I'm definitely of that generation. I'm Generation X. So
yeah.
These are the filmmakers I grew up idolizing.
Well, they created a whole new direction for cinema.
That's right. They created cinema in a way that you can kind of go, wow, like this can be my world, right? They created, they basically, they were world creationist, if you will, right?
Yeah,
they create worlds that you can just go in there, believe that world, live as one of the characters, and just be submerged in this environment. And
you were born into it. You were born the year Star Wars came out.
I was, yeah, 77. Yes. Yeah, Star Wars, the year I was born. So, like, I see Star Wars as my movie, so to speak.
It's your birthright.
It's my birth movie. Like, you know, people have birthstones. That's my birth movie.
Well, let's go back to how Saw came together. And mm-hmm. There have been 10 of them. Saw X, which I call Socks.
Socks. Very nice, yep.
But tell me just how it began, because it's really hard to get your first movie made, no matter who you are.
Yes.
So you were in film school.
We were in film school. So yeah, so let me give you a little bit of a fun story here. So Lee and I, when we graduated college, when university, RMIT, when we were 20 or 21, the first thing Lee wanted to do was he wanted to go backpacking around the world. And he was going with two of his other buddies. And I was like, hey, man, that sounds great. You going to America? And they're like, yeah, we're going to go by Hollywood and all that. I was like, can I tag along? So I kind of tag along on Lee's trip with his buddies. And during that time, so we backpacked through the U.S. Our first stop was here in L.A.
Wow.
And this is how young and naive Lee and I were. We thought, you know what? We're just going to go to Hollywood and we're going to, you know, we're going to go pitch them something.
Wow.
And at that time, Lee and I had worked on a little, we had worked on a script. We had written a script together, worked on a project called The Debt Collector, about an evil tax man, a demonic tax man from hell who comes up to the surface to collect souls, lost souls. And so we wrote the script. I did some drawing artwork for it. And when we came over on our little holiday backpacking trip, we thought, you know what would be cool? We had a list of producers that we admire, and we were just gonna call them up, call them up, and we know that no one was really gonna take our call. So what we were gonna do was we were gonna call up late at night, when no one's in the office anymore, and we're gonna leave a voicemail with the pitch on the voicemail machine.
Well, it helps to have an Australian accent.
It helps to be stupid, young, and naive. I tell you that.
That's true.
So yeah, and so we did that. We had Roger Corman on our list, and then we had Brian Yuzner on our list as well. And I think Charles Band, Full Moon, was on our list.
Wow.
I'm a big fan of Full Moon, and so that's what we did. So we rang up a few places. We left our pitch on their answering machine, like during midnight, so where we knew no one would actually pick up the phone and hang up on us. And after we left our pitches, we didn't really hear anything about it. We give them Lee's manager's phone number, because at the time Lee was an actor, and so he had a manager and agent and stuff like that.
In Australia.
So we left these people an Australian contact number. and we just thought, bloody hell, no one's going to ever really get back to us. What do we think we are? And so we left. We left LA. We traveled around US. We backpacked to New York, backpacked to Vegas, backpacked to New Orleans. And then finally, we thought, you know what? We should give Lee's manager a call just to see if she had anything. We called her up, and she goes, boys, where have you guys been? One of these places called us back.
Wow.
And it was, apparently, it was Brian Yuzna's company that called us back.
That's amazing. That story is fantastic.
So that was like, that. So if even though that project eventually, like nothing eventuated from it, but that gave Lee and I so much hope.
Yeah.
And believe that if we do it, if we have a cool, exciting project, and if we really believe in it, we can get it off. We can get it off the ground and get it off the ground, maybe potentially in Hollywood, in America. And so when we got back to Australia, we really just put our heads down and go, we need to come up with a cool project that everyone's going to want, that we can just pitch it to anyone in Hollywood. Somehow we'll get our foot through the door, pitch it to anyone, and they're going to want this script from us. And that's how Saw eventually came about.
That is the most incredible
roundabout story
introductory story to a career. That's fantastic. And then, so how did that all come together? Was it funded by one company, or were there co-producers and Lionsgate picked it up, or were they involved from the beginning with Peter Block, I assume, was the guy?
Yes. And so it was a bit of a journey to get the movie eventually made, but that was only because we took a year to write the script, because we wanted to write a really good script, because we felt like no one knows who the hell we are, so our script is our secret weapon. Right. And so we designed a really smart script. We didn't want it to just be a throwaway movie.
Right.
We want it to actually, eventually potentially go somewhere. We had high aspirations. And so we wrote the script, and then and we spent a year writing it, actually. And then we spent another year with two Australian producers that really loved the project and really believed in Lee and I. And so we tried to initially get the movie off the ground in Australia, but we couldn't get the funding for it. Mm-hmm. And then Lee's manager said, you know what? I know an agent at Paradigm, or at the time, yeah. I cannot remember what company it was, that is in TV, but he would love to read the script. And so we passed the script on. He read the script. The agent read the script and was like, wow, this is really unique, and wanted to meet with Lee and myself. And so Lee and I thought, you know what? I remember at that particular moment, I had been out of work for like 3 to 5 months. I had just finished my contract work at a TV station. I was just doing some small little TV job at the local Australian Broadcasting Corporation.
Right.
And ABC. The ABC, that's right. Not to be confused with the American Broadcasting Corporation.
Where I've done a lot of work.
Yes, you have. but this was TV. This wasn't like making cool movie stuff, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So we thought, you know what? So at that moment, I didn't really have a lot of money, but Lee and I just felt like, you know what? If we're going to spend all that money on a plane ticket to go all the way to Hollywood to meet with an agent for our script, let's shoot a scene from the script.
Oh.
Who knows? Because you want to be the actor and I want to be the director. Like, we don't have anything else to show for it. Let's shoot something.
Right.
And we shot the scene in the movie, the scene that was played by Shawnee Smith in the first one, where she wore the jaw trap.
Shawnee Smith, yeah.
Yeah, and so that became our calling card for the script. So we made the little short. I shot it in 2 days, edited it quickly, bent it onto a CD back in the days.
Yeah.
And we would accompany that CD with the screenplay that would go out to a bunch of agents. So the agent would then send it to a bunch of producers around town.
Right. The importance of the agent. Yeah.
Yeah, the agent, yes, the importance of agent, his name is Ken Greenblatt, and he's not an agent anymore. He's moved on to do other stuff, but we'll always be very thankful to him for like sending it out and believing in the project. And then the project event, the script and the CD landed at Greg Hoffman's desk. And at the time he partnered up with Mark Berg and Oren Koolis at Evolution. I think it was a talent agent management company.
Right.
And they left the short, they left the script, and they met with Lee and I. They were literally the very first people that we met with in town. And so we came to LA. The agent had set up a whole bunch of meetings that week. We met with these guys for the first meeting, and at the end of that meeting they said, we don't have a lot of money to make it. We can make it really low budget, but James, you can direct. Lee, you can act in it. Let's go do this.
Wow.
Yeah. And we can share, if the movie does well, we can share in the profit together.
You have one amazing story after another here, James.
I would say that was probably the biggest mistake that came out of their mouth at the time.
Not as far as you were concerned.
Not as far as Lee and I were concerned. So we stepped out of that first meeting going, is this for real? Like, we cannot believe, because like in our brains, we were like, it's really hard to break into Hollywood, which, let's face it, it freaking is,
yeah.
Right? It really is. And you kind of need to have a lot of you got to be lucky and still have, your ducks in a row to kind of get there. And so we did a bunch of meetings throughout the week. I think the other company that was really interested in it was Gold Circle.
Mm-hmm.
But Mark Berg, Oren Koolis, and Greg Hoffman were willing to take a chance with Lee and myself. making it. And so we went back to them and said, let's do it.
So did you make the film first before going out to distributors, or did Lionsgate become involved during the process?
We started shooting the movie first, the production of the movie first. But then very early on, Peter Block and Jason Constantine from Lionsgate were pulled into it. I think they have that relationship with the producers, and Peter Block and Jason Constantine, those guys are incredible.
They're such great people.
Such, you know, fans of the genre, yeah. And when they, you know, read the script, saw the short, and knew what we were trying to do, they loved it, and they got in pretty early on. So even though we took the movie to Sundance to premiere the film, I think by then Lionsgate was already on board.
Fantastic. Yeah. A great way to go to Sundance.
with a potential distributor in the wing, yes.
Yes. So I love hearing stories about first-time filmmakers seeing their first films with their first audience. Tell me about, was that Sundance? Was that the first public screening?
Yes. They tested the movie, which at the time I had no idea what test screenings were. That's how young I was, and I'm like, "What's this test screening thing?"
It's scary.
It is frightening. It is scary. I was actually back in Australia at the time. I had shot the film. We got a visa. We came over. We shot the film, and then I had to go back. And then when I was back there, that was when. I think at the time, there were certain powers that be at Lionsgate that still felt the movie is like, you know, it's a cheap little low-budget horror film.
Right.
And they were, you know, their DVD straight-to-video sort of department was exploding, right? It was very popular in the 90s at the time. or it was starting to get very big. And they felt that Soul was potentially going to be a video movie.
Right.
Yeah.
Anything that doesn't cost over a couple of million bucks should go direct.
Should go direct to video. Yeah. I mean, that's kind of like, we don't want to waste money on that. But it wasn't until they tested the movie and it tested through the roof.
Wow.
Yeah. Like the first testing was like in the like 80s or something, really the high 80s. And they were like, wait, is this for real? Like they just could not believe it. Right. Uh-huh. Apparently at the end of the movie, they told me that towards the end of the movie when the twist was revealed, like the audience stood up and yelled at the screen.
Wow.
I was like, oh my God, that sounds incredible. Uh-huh. And then they're like, is this a fluke? And so then they thought, let's do a second test screening. And they took it outside of LA. They took it to Vegas, I think.
Oh, yeah.
And it tested even higher.
Wow.
And it went crazy. And it was then that Lionsgate just felt, I think we got something here. And then they started to really get behind it.
Yeah. So yeah. Tell me what it felt like when you were surrounded by the audience at Sundance.
At Sundance.
Feel it play.
Well, I can tell you this. my memory of screening my movie to an audience for the very first time was just me and Lee pacing outside in the lobby back and forth, just sweating bullets.
Oh,
we
God.
Were so nervous.
So you didn't want to sit with the audience as it played? You wanted
we
to
would,
listen?
We would pop in every now and then to just kind of check out. We would come in for like moments that we knew would be kind of fun to watch.
Yeah.
But I couldn't sit through the whole film with the audience. I was so nervous. Yeah. Just because like I felt the film, you know, like it was a low budget movie. I this vision in my head for the movie that ultimately I didn't really feel I got. I felt like I had this bigger film in my head. In my head, I was shooting a Hitchcock movie.
Right, right.
Right. But I ended up shooting like this, you know, $700,000 movie, which was the budget we had to shoot the film with.
And it went on to make $50 million in just in the U.S.
Yeah, just theatrically U.S. Yeah. for the first one, yeah.
Yeah. So that opened doors to you and Lee as writers, you as a director, and so it was time for a creepy doll movie.
Right. One of the things I remember reading about Steven Spielberg saying he picked his next movies kind of based on how he felt on his last film. You know, like if he made a lot of like. I know after Jaws, he had a lot of practical effects and the shark wasn't quite working, right? So that's why the next one, he wanted more control in the effects department. That's why he went and did Close Encounter.
Right.
Not
so many effects in that, right?
But they were effects that he could control easier,
exactly.
Right? They were more VFX instead of like mechanical sharks that did not want to work. Yeah.
That you put in water and why would they ever work
in
water?
Salt water apparently is bad. But after Saw, you know, Lee and I kind of got the reputation for being, you know, like the gory trap guys. And I felt like, I don't know if that's the representation I wanted
of
myself.
Torture porn was a big deal at that time with Hostel.
Yeah, I blame Eli for that. No.
Entirely your fault, Eli.
Yeah, Eli. Listen, I look back to that period now, the Splat Pack, as we were called.
Yeah.
Hindsight, you know, with a lot of love.
Yeah, you wear it with pride.
I wear it with pride now, yeah. Back then I was like, oh, I'm not sure if this is what I want to be known, but now I'm like, yeah, that was fucking cool back then.
Yeah.
But after Saw, I felt like I wanted to do something kind of more moody, more atmospheric, and that's why we went back to a ventriloquist horror film.
Yeah.
Went to a proper ventriloquist horror film.
And you had a little more money this time. You had a little, but not as much control. Or were you still working independent?
Dead Silence. Dead Silence was my first studio film.
Yeah.
And let's just say there was a lot of learning curve.
A lot of compromises.
Well, just you know, like all those horror stories you hear about. You know, an indie filmmaker that had an indie hit that will go on to do a studio film and how tough it was a transition for them.
Right.
So I learn a lot. I learn a lot of the process, just the politics behind it all, and kind of what you need to do to kind of, to make the film that you ultimately want to make. And, you know, what I learned ultimately from that is you know, as a director, you live and die by the movie that you put out.
Yeah.
People are not going to know about all the brouhaha behind the scene. What you put out is the movie that you're going to be known for.
Right.
And so I learned to fight for my films now.
Yeah.
So I learned
to do. And
you pick
your battles as well.
You pick your battles. That's right. You let certain things go and other things you just go, no, this is how we should do it.
Now, it was not a huge success that spawned a series of movies like Things to Come. But your next one was Death Sentence, which was a sequel to Death Wish by Brian Garfield.
Yeah, in the books, right?
The books,
in the book world. I think after Dead Silence, I wanted to branch a little bit outside of the, you know, quote unquote horror genre, so to speak.
Yeah, this is more of an action thriller.
It's an action, yeah. I'm a big fan of revenge thrillers.
Yeah.
And I just thought, you know, this might be fun for me to do something a little bit on the outskirts. But, you know, to me, Death Sentence still played like a horror film
right.
in a lot of ways. You know,
it's
more grounded.
Cat and mouse and tension and suspense and build
right,
and release.
Yeah, and so that was cool, yeah, to play more into the suspense and into, like, you know, the everyday sort of potential human horror of it all. You know, digging into the darker side of humanity, if you will. Thematically, that was a fun one for me to dive into. And the best thing about that movie was getting the chance to work with those actors for me.
Yeah.
Kevin Bacon, John Goodman, Garrett Hedlund.
Fantastic. Garrett Hedlund was in Unbroken, which I produced.
That's right. Yes, I remember Garrett telling me about that years later. Yeah.
Great actor.
He's such a, he's a good dude. I love Garrett.
Really good.
Yeah.
Now, then you spent some time working with Tobe Hooper developing a Texas Chainsaw.
I did.
Version. Yeah. So tell me about that process, because Tobe was one of my favorite people, dear, dear friend, and just a teddy bear.
Yeah.
You know, you want to hug him when he...
I know. I love... One of my favorite things about talking to people about Tobe is just like how much of a gentleman he is. He truly is. I always tell people this, that are not familiar with our world, that the horror crowd are the nicest people you meet.
Absolutely.
The most down-to-earth, normal, very well-adjusted, fun people you meet. You know, they're quite different to comedians.
Yeah, that's for sure.
You know,
but those dinners we've had,
yeah.
You know, everybody is so supportive of each other, and they want everybody to succeed. There's not this cutthroat competition like, if you win, I lose.
You know? Right. Mick, you know why I think that is? I do think a lot of that had to do with, like, we are the black sheep of the business. And even though we are very big in the mainstream world today, I still very much have that underdog mentality.
Yeah.
Like, even as successful as, you know, like, my franchises have become, I don't see myself like that. I really don't. I still see, like, I have a lot to prove still.
Yeah. Well, it's a great feeling. And I think if you don't feel that way, you're a hack. You calcify, you don't grow, you don't evolve with the
world of
film. You
know? Yeah. I totally agree with that mindset. Yeah. Like, I feel like a little bit of that feeling of being on edge helps keep you a better filmmaker.
Yeah.
It keeps you wanting to fight to do something more, something better.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, you always want to do something better than what you've done before, you know? So tell me more about working with Toby and whatever happened to the Chainsaw Project.
So this was during the period after between Death Sentence and Insidious.
Right.
And where I kind of like it was that period where I kind of like took a bit of time off to kind of like, you know, assess with what I want to do and just kind of like just put the brakes on a little, because I felt like
you had three really different experiences.
Different experience, yeah, and it was exhausting, and I just wanted to kind of take the time to just sleep in, just chill, hang out with my dog. I got a puppy during that time period.
Not have a call time.
Yeah, and exactly. Not have to wake up like, what, 5 or 6 in the morning. And during that period, I was trying to, you know, I was still getting approached for a lot of, you know, for a lot of horror projects, a lot of remakes and reboots. Really, there were only two or three projects in terms of remakes or reboots that I was interested in terms of established IPs. One was The Blob. I think that was after Rob Zombie was attached to it.
Oh, really?
They came to me. And I was, you know, kind of like, kind of flirting with that for like 2 seconds.
Yeah.
And then Texas Chainsaw came up, and I thought, oh, I wonder if there's something cool I could do with this. And I kind of joked that, well, people already know me as the saw guy. Maybe I can put the chain in front of the saw and be also partially known as the chainsaw guy. But I didn't really want to necessarily commit to it until I had met Toby and had gotten his blessing.
Yeah.
So
what a sweet, generous guy.
Yes. And so, yeah, I remember like with the producer hanging out with Toby and Steve Susko at the time as well. And,
oh, was he attached as the writer?
Yeah. That was a while. Yeah, it was a while ago. Yeah. I love Steve as well. And so I think this was during that Saw grudge period.
Right.
That was very popular. And so we were like, the idea of like collaborating together was kind of fun. And we met up with Toby, and I love it. And I already met, obviously, Toby previously from the Masters of Horror dinners. It was just cool to just catch up with Toby and just kind of pick his brains and just hear what he had to say. He was awesome about everything.
God, do I miss him.
I do, yeah. I bet, yes. Yeah.
Well, you went back to horror with Insidious following that. And so that didn't work out. It just fell apart like so many things that in Hollywood do.
Yeah, it just sort of petered away.
Yeah.
But then during that period, I was like, oh, you know what? Lee and I kind of came back together. Yeah. We're like, you know what we should do? We love ghost stories. So why don't we go and tell a cool modern ghost story, a classic haunted house story. But
you're a poltergeist.
Literally. That's basically like, Lee, how do I make my own poltergeist? My version of poltergeist set in the burbs.
Yeah.
Find my Craig T. Nelson in Patrick Wilson.
Yeah.
And that's what we did. We set out to make our own haunted house movie with a twist to it. But the goal was to make it really low budget, really cheap. That way,
so
we
had control.
So that we would, retain creative control. And really, my mindset during that period of my fourth movie after Death Sentence was I just wanted to have fun again.
Yeah,
I want to go back and have fun again and make movies with my mates that I grew up with and just kind of make a film like how I used to do them back in film school, back in my college days. And so I bought the fastest computer at the time and invested in a computer because I edited the movie myself. Yeah. I colored the movie myself. I wanted to do all this stuff on my own.
Wow.
Yeah, and so I go, Lee, you and I write and you act in it, I'll direct it again, and we'll get our buddies to star in it, and we'll find a few other, you know, potential really great character actors to kind of like populate this world. And that's what we did. That's why I reached out to Lynn Shea.
Yeah, we love
Lynn. We love Lynn. And so it truly was just like getting all my friends to play the ghouls and ghosts in the world.
And you're an artist as well. Do you storyboard stuff?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I draw. I draw a bit. They're definitely much better artists now that I work with.
That you can afford.
That I can afford to get them to do it for me now. But no, yeah, if I have to, I'll draw it myself. Mm. I would point out that the Dalton in Insidious, all his little child drawing in the movie, that was all me.
Excellent.
Yeah.
That's great. One of the things I like to do when I'm doing something a child writes or something is use my left hand.
That's exactly what I did, Meg.
Really?
That's
really?
Exactly what I did. Yes, I had to use... See, I'm left-handed, so I have to use my right hand.
So you would do the other hand.
Yeah, I'll do the other hand, yeah.
That's so funny.
But the hardest part is, as you draw, like you're trying to draw, is because... Even though my hand doesn't have that much control, but I'm thinking like an adult.
Right.
And so the mindset, when you're a child, you draw things very different to how you see things. And so as I'm drawing it, I'm going, no. Even though the drawing is very crooked, there's not a lot of strength to
it's
it.
It's still sophisticated.
But it's, yeah, exactly. There's too much of a sophisticated thinking behind the drawing. So that was a lot harder than it looked.
Yeah, that's great. Well, then after Insidious, I mean, The Conjuring, Insidious was not a big box office hit, but later spawned a couple of sequels. Mm-hmm. But The Conjuring was huge. And it launched two franchises, the Annabelle franchise and the Nun franchise.
Yeah, within the Conjuring franchise.
Within the Conjuring world, like, yeah.
Yeah, spaceship within the mothership, as I call them.
Yeah. The pods.
I would say, I've known about the Warrens for a long time, as we tend to, you know, if any one of us who are, you know, remotely into the supernatural and ghost huntings and all that, at some point in our life, we would have heard about the Warrens.
Absolutely.
And then, but the other thing ultimately that pushed me to do The Conjuring was I remember having a meeting with Don Murphy. Do you know Don?
Oh, yeah. I did know Don.
Don Murphy of Angry Films. Yeah. And, you know, and I like Don, you know, like he's a really kind of cool, nerdy guy with a lot of kind of cool ideas and tastes. And this was back then, you know, like, I met up with him on just a general meeting because, you know, we share similar love and taste for things. And this was right after Insidious had opened. And he said, James, Insidious is great, but what you need to do now is you need to do an Insidious, but for the studio.
Right.
If you want to move back into the studio world of filmmaking and you want to go where I think you want to go with your career.
And to reach a large audience.
Reach a larger, a bigger, more mainstream audience. You got to do Insidious, but at that studio level. And those words, he said it very fleetingly. He just threw it out. But those words really stuck with me.
Mm.
And you know, the more after Insidious, I was trying to find out what I want to do next. It felt to me that doing Insidious, but a more grounded version of Insidious based on a true life story was the way to go.
Right.
And then that was how I eventually met up with Peter Safran and the guys, you know, the group at New Line. And so
New Line was part of Warner Brothers, so you had a much wider potential audience there.
Right. Yeah.
Now, with Insidious and with The Conjuring, you did parts one and two. What did it feel like to hand it off to other filmmakers?
It's a bit bittersweet, you know, just because I felt the same thing as well with Saw. You know, you created this world, you create this world and the characters, and I do love them. But my thing is, I just felt like I've told all the stories I wanted to tell as a director, not necessarily as a writer or producer, because I used to have more stories. But as you know, directing is so consuming. It's exhausting. And
it's every waking moment.
It's every waking moment. Yeah, it just eats up every part of your life. And you know, having done one and two, I felt like I've really established the world, and I felt like I'm ready to pass it on to someone else.
Right, pass the baton.
If you will. And I felt like the world is established strong enough that if people come on to play with us, you know, I'll let them make the movie that they wanted to make, but at least the framework is in place. And if they branch too far outside of that framework, I can kind of say, let's keep it within this world that we've created. That doesn't feel like the Conjuring world or the Insidious world.
Right. So as a producer, were you watching from afar, or were you Steven Spielberg on Poltergeist?
I was definitely more helping out with developing the script and the stories and the scares ultimately.
Yeah.
And then letting the director bring their vision to life. I still had my day job as a director as well. So I'm off like either directing, you know, Aquaman or Fast and Furious 7.
Yeah.
So I still had other things.
Yeah, and you know, a filmmaker is an artist as well as a technician. So there are the realities you have to work with and the technical aspects of it that are so important. And so much of creating scares is technical, in addition to being creative, especially if you want to do it in a way that has not been done over and over and over and have a cat jump out of a trash can. You know?
Yep.
So tell me about how you go about that creation, because you're famous for your developing of scare scenes in movies.
Yeah, I get really offended when people just dismisses scares or jump scares, right?
Yeah.
I agree that cheap jump scares are cheap and easy to do, but good ones are really hard to pull off.
Absolutely.
And to be successful, like, people don't understand that. Like, it takes so much understanding of the genre, of film crafting, and ultimately of psychology, right? So often, as I'm designing my scares, I'm trying to look at it as an audience sitting in a dark room, disconnected from what I'm seeing, and go, how would I react to that if that was me just watching someone else's film?
Right.
And so I try to look at it from that mindset and go, okay, I've seen tons of scares. I know, and today's audiences are so, you know, have been exposed to so many things that they're pretty jaded. They've seen it all. And so
they come here comes somebody says something funny, something scary.
That's right.
Is gonna happen.
Even if they don't know it, like technically, but it's so kind of like, it's so ingrained in them that even if they don't understand it, they can feel like a scare's coming. Right? Like they know the tricks. Like they can kind of feel like the rhythm that a scare has. And for me, it's all about breaking these rhythm that you have in these moments. And so it's hard to come up with jump scares or scares, a build up to a scare that you build up on that tension and then you release that tension. It definitely is not something that that I just, it's not something that one can just do lightly and easily.
It's not automatic. I mean, John Carpenter once told me, I can make an audience jump by just running black leader through a projector, hit a white frame and a loud noise, and it'll make them jump. But are they going to remember it on their way home?
Right.
You know?
That's right, yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's not, you're not scaring them to their soul. It's just a visceral thing.
It's startling them,
it's
not
startling,
scaring.
That's right.
Yeah. Along comes a total change of pace, Furious 7, a giant franchise, huge scale. This is a studio movie in the truest sense of the word. It's the seventh episode of a franchise of very expensive, high-grossing films.
Right.
So tell me about how you got that and then how you approached it.
I know it's probably the strangest one on my resume. If you look at my IMDb, it's definitely the one that pops out.
It's like Unbroken on mine.
Yes. you know, it's a strange one, but people that know me know that I'm a, you know, as much as I love the low budget filmmaking, and I have that low budget filmmaking mentality, I also have a love for big budget filmmaking as well. I love big budget movies. Hollywood movies, yeah. All the stuff that we grew up with. And I've always, you know, when I was younger, aspired to want to make those kind of movies. I'm a big action fan, a big action junkie. And for me, you know, crossing into action, you know, it wasn't hard at all for me, because to me, like, designing my action set pieces is akin to me designing my horror set pieces.
Right.
You just have to kind of look at it with different hats on. Mm-hmm. But it's still about creating tension within them, suspense. And I like to tell stories within my scares or within my action set pieces. I like to tell an opening, a middle, and an end within those little moments. And so I applied the same kind of methodology to a slightly different genre.
Well, you're also staging these things on a much grander scale.
Right.
So shooting stunt sequences, especially with cars, is the most difficult kind of filmmaking there is, it seems to me.
Yes, in the practical effects world. Yes. You know, now that more and more movies are made with visual effects, you know, created in computers, right. You know, it was fun to make a film, you know, to be part of a film series like The Fast and Furious that actually still, you know, relies on a lot of practical effects, right? Like crashing cars and stunts and explosion.
And you can't do those things over and over and over either.
No, yeah. You got to plan them well. You got to design them well. You got to have an incredible team behind you to kind of, you know, from your stunt department to your second unit, like everyone needs to be on board. And the cool thing, the great thing about something like Furious 7 is I pretty much have like the best of the best to work with.
Yeah.
And so for me, the opportunity to work with big toys was really fun.
Well, you had more of it to come, but with more visual effects with Aquaman.
Yeah.
So this was your first superhero movie, and that is a genre unto itself.
Yeah.
And this was DC, not Marvel, so it had a totally different approach from what the Marvel approach was. So what were the marching orders on that?
It was, I mean, the good thing was, you know, the fact that DC is a part of Warner Brothers, and I've already kind of really established my place at Warner Brothers with the Conjuring universe, and just like they feel like, you know, I feel like I know them well and they knew me well, and so for the first Aquaman, they really trusted me to just kind of go out there and make the movie I wanted to make.
Ultimately. Well, you have kind of proven yourself.
Yeah, at that point, I was kind of coming off Conjuring 2 and Fast and Furious 7. So, definitely that was, you know, they trusted me there. And I think they liked my vision for it, which was I wanted to just kind of make a fun superhero movie that really lean into the Silver Age of Aquaman, of the comic book.
And were you a fan of Aquaman comics before you became involved?
I was a fan I never collected all of it, but I would read like now, everyone, and then just because I do love the world. But obviously, once I was a part of the film, I did a really deep dive into that world. Yeah. No pun intended, but I definitely It's hard to stay away from puns
yes.
when I'm working Aquaman.
I'm sure. Yeah. And I love the conceptualization of Aquaman in the film, so different from the blonde, you know, superhero of the comic books of the 60s.
Yes,
know?
Yeah, definitely, yeah. That is definitely credit to Zach for casting Momoa. And so once I met Jason in the first film, you know, like, you see who he is. So it made it easy to write the movie. You're like, I'm just going to write it to this guy.
Yeah, he's
just
a really merman. Embrace,
exactly. Just just kind of lean and just embrace Jason's larger-than-life personality.
Yeah, it's great. So it's a big success, but you came home. You came home with Malignant. So tell me about that. Was that you'd done these two giant franchise movies, one that hopefully was the beginning of a franchise, but was part of the DC franchise.
Right.
And Malignant comes along, and it's like a return to your roots.
Yeah, I have found that I really enjoy going back and forth.
Yeah.
I don't like just doing one thing for too long.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like when I went from Insidious to The Conjuring and then Insidious 2 again, I felt like, oh my God, I'm Haunted House out. And I need to take a break. And so when Fast and Furious 7 came along, it was a great change of pace for me because it allowed me to exercise a different muscle in my brain.
Right.
And so I really like that. I really appreciate being fortunate enough to have the luxury to be able to go back and forth.
Yeah.
And so when I do a big film, the last thing I want is to do another next big movie.
Right.
So I wanted to go back to my roots and you know, do something smaller, do something more practical. That's my thing is, you know, after so much visual effects, I'm like, oh, I'm sick of it. I want to go back to do more hands-on. It's on the stage, yeah. I want to work with animatronics, puppets, you know, like prosthetics, you know, like the blood and all the fun stuff that I don't get to do on the other kind of
And
films.
You got some of your best reviews ever on Malignant, too.
Yeah, who would have thought?
It's great. Did you see Miike's Masters of Horror imprint? It also had the head in hand thing.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yes. I know. I just wanted to kind of go back to like, you know, just like a lot of like the 80s sort of video movies I grew up with.
Yeah, yeah.
Like I would reference that Malignant to me is like the kind of movie that you would find at the back of the video store in the horror section.
Right.
That sometimes maybe they curtain off.
Right. Yeah. 17 and home, above only. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so like, and you have to really search for it to find it. That was kind of the spirit of something I wanted to do. But I wanted to do a more sort of elevated version of that.
Right.
You know, do it with like, you know, all the technical know-how and everything that I've learned, you know, from, you know, since then. So
well, your production company, Atomic Monster, you're developing movies, making TV shows and developing things like that. So tell me about the business side of James Wan.
Right. Well, it's really interesting. It's really funny. I mean, like, I hope people believe me when I say this. The projects I pick are never based around money. I don't do something for the sake of like, hey, this thing is going to make money. That'll be great. Everything I do has to be something that I'm passionate about. You know, if I'm not passionate about wanting to direct it, but if I still like the story or if I believe in that filmmaker, I want to support that filmmaker.
Right.
I really do feel very fortunate that Greg Hoffman, Mark Berg, Aaron Coolers, very early on in my career, gave Lee and I the opportunity to direct. Like, there's no reason for them to believe in us, but they did. And they put their own money into it. So, like, not only did they take a chance with us, they put their own money into it. And it's obviously, it's paid off big time for them.
Big time.
And I'm very thankful for that. So, like, because hopefully what that does is encourage other, you know, investors and producers to potentially do the same for other filmmakers. So now, I like to think that I'm now in the position where I can kind of pay it back.
Yeah.
And so I like to kind of give, you know, like upcoming filmmakers the opportunity that they may or may not have otherwise.
So you can be a cheerleader.
Yes. Yeah. Basically, yeah. Be a supporter and be their producer. And listen, I mean, obviously, I need these movies to work, to be successful so that we can do more.
And you've got the experience to be able to be a great resource for these young filmmakers.
Yeah. Yeah, basically, I'm like, you guys, use me as much as you want to use me. I'm happy to help you however you want to help me. Like, there's no ego on my part. It's still your movie. You go make the movie that you want to make, but whatever you want me to help you out with, I will do my best to help you out.
And now the holidays are coming up, so it's time for your new Aquaman movie, which is coming out very shortly as we sit here talking now.
Yes.
So tell me about going back to that big underwater world of Aquaman and returning to that giant production.
It's daunting. I mean, like, you know, just kind of like, you know, when you go back to a smaller movie, you really feel the pressure lifted off you, right? You can really see the difference. And then when you go back to this, you know, the first movie made over $1 billion. And so, like, you're like, how the heck am I going to live up to it? But, you know, I love the people I worked with. I love the world and the chance to sort of expand on the first movie. All I can do is just, you know, go out there and make the movie I wanted to make and whatever happens, happens.
And you have so much more time and so many more resources. If you have an idea that's outrageous, you can fulfill it.
Yes. And believe me, this one is not afraid to be outrageous.
Well, also then back to your producer role, you've got Night Swim coming out as well. Yes. Tell me about that. I only know the title.
Yeah, Night Swim, when Bryce McGuire came to us and pitched us this haunted swimming pool idea, I was like, say no more. I get it.
But is there a creepy doll in it?
There's no creepy doll. Yeah. There's a toy in it, but it's not a creepy toy. But I was like, again, what drew me to that was like, see, I get this because it is something so domesticated. It's something that we're so familiar with that, you know, that most people have swimming pools these days in their homes. And we can see the kind of horror that is potentially, you know, the kind of move, the scares that could be built around something like that. So I he made a little short that, that he went that, you know, a while back. And so I saw the short, I go, I know the movie that I think you're going to make.
Yeah. Which is so great.
I always tell upcoming filmmakers, don't be afraid to go and shoot a short, because they're now, you know, we now live in a world where, you know, like YouTube, TikTok, where like we're willing, you know, the studio and finances, the money people are willing to take chances on you if you go and do something that can be effective in a short amount of time.
Well, you've done so many things as a writer, as a producer, director. You've done what people call torture porn. You've done creepy dolls. You've done haunted houses. You've done superheroes. You've done car crashes, all of that. What have you not done yet that you're dying to do?
That's a really, really good question. I think I let the cat out of the bag a while ago when I was promoting, I think, Megan, on a Reddit promo thing. I said that I have been, David Leslie Johnson, who's the screenwriter, I don't know if you know David.
Like no.
He wrote Orphan, and he did...
Oh, I sure know him by his work.
He did Orphan, and he did Conjuring for me, Conjuring 2 and 3 for me, and he's writing Conjuring 4 right now. We have been secretly working for the last 2 years on our own adaptation of Call of Cthulhu.
Wow. Yeah. So you're getting into the world of Lovecraft.
I would love to. Whether or not it will actually happen, I don't know. But we've just been kind of secretly adapting it ourselves for no one.
Well, yeah. What a great place to wrap up. This is great. James, I can't tell you how much I appreciate you joining us here, especially face-to-face.
Mick, thank you so much for doing this. I've been wanting to do this for a while, and thank you for not giving up on me.
Never. James, thanks so much, and good luck with the two movies.
Thank you. Thank you, and good luck with whatever you do next. I'm a big fan of yours, Mick, so I'm very happy to be here, and I want to see what you do next as well.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris. Download new episodes every Wednesday or subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Postmortem with Mick Garris is produced by Mick Garris and Joe Russo. Our sound engineer is Christopher Leon Price. Our announcer is Jeff Gelb. Our graphic designer is John Holland. And our theme was composed and performed by Bill Burney with additional music by John Jasensky. If you're enjoying our show, please take a moment to rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you for listening to the Dread Podcast Network.